Welcome to CFO Europe's Cash Clinic, a new series of panel discussions devoted to your cash and liquidity management strategies. I'm Janet Kirsnar, Editor-in-Chief of CFO Europe magazine, and I'm delighted to host today's Cash Clinic from our CFO TV studios here in London. The topic today, working capital management, and how senior finance executives like yourselves can spearhead best practice initiatives in this area during the downturn. I'm joined by experts from today's Cash Clinic sponsors, CJ Wimley, Executive Vice President of Corporate Solutions at SunGard's Avantgarde, a technology and services company dedicated to liquidity management. And Daniel Venthaus, a Senior Director and the head of the private equity arm of REL Consulting Group, a working capital management specialist. And Rajesh Mehta, EMEA Head of Treasury and Trade Solutions at Citi. And what we want to do first of all is focus on receivables, an area that's top of mind for so many CFOs today. In other words, how can they make sure their companies get paid? And to help us focus on why it's top of mind for so many CFOs, and to provide some practical advice, Jason Carrion, CFO Europe's deputy editor, recently caught up with Mark Lampton, who discussed his work in receivables management while finance chief of the UK and Ireland arms of the technology company HP. Here's what the two of them had to say.
Mark, when it comes to managing working capital and specifically receivables in the current environment, you advocate a back to basics approach. What do you mean by that?
I think it starts with orientating the organization around the importance of cash and the extent to which working capital drives shareholder value. Next, I would advocate looking at setting global credit limits rather than limits that are specific either to business units or to local geographies. Reviewing those limits as well is critical. Last year's limits are unlikely to be appropriate for this year's trading. I would also look at your invoice production schedules. How quickly are you getting invoices out the door? Is it possible to accelerate the billing cycles for your invoices? Bringing them forwards even 2 or 3 days makes a difference to your working capital requirements. Dedicating resources around dispute management is also important. It's all about keeping your collectors focused upon the interface with the customer. And having others focused on any internal resolution requirements. Collector performance league tables is a thing I'm quite keen on as well. It creates a healthy air of competition within the collection teams, and it also allows individuals to calibrate how well they're performing against their colleagues. If you go one stage further, you can even add some element of variable compensation to your collectors to make it kind of worth spending the additional time and going the extra mile to get that cash in before the end of the trading period. Consequence management is critical. So the business units, the teams that sit outside of the finance organization must understand that there are consequences of being unable to get the cash in for the invoices that have been raised. And that consequence management would typically be around some kind of a proactive reserving approach. And finally, I would look to always drive the credit teams to chase the pipeline. In other words, increasingly call ahead of the date before which the invoice is due, ensure the customer's happy with the invoice, that in fact they have received the invoice and that it matches with the purchase order. These are just basic things, but things which can actually stop you ultimately getting cash into the organization.
You mentioned the billing cycle there, and one thing that I find interesting is that overdue payments are not always just due to customers paying late, and the company actually doing the billing also shares some of the blame, right?
Yes, that's often the case. In my experience, particularly with larger companies, processes have over time become segregated and teams focus on process expertise and process efficiencies, which is absolutely the right thing to do. But sometimes the alignment of those disparate processes can mean that ultimately it becomes more difficult to get the cash in. They're not necessarily situations where the customer refuses to pay, they're situations where the customer feels they can't pay. In those situations, it's important to carve out an element of resource within your collections team to focus just on the internal issue management to drive the resolution of those processes. But it's a lot more than that as well, because if that is a significant part of your aged receivable balance, it's important that you start to wrap around that some key metrics which enable you to comprehensively report this type of inefficiency back to your business areas that are generating those. And I think putting metrics around those, both in terms of the magnitude and the aging of those disputes, can be really powerful. Another area that I would also advocate, which is internally focused but nonetheless very effective, would be looking to ensure that your sales teams remain interested in managing the customer to the point that they've actually paid the invoice itself. So that might mean that you hold back an element of the commission that was earned by the sales team until such times as you've received full payment on those invoices. And also, I think it's important for us to involve the sales teams in dispute resolution. They manage the relationship with the customer primarily, although not exclusively.
Another thing you've mentioned is the practice of active or dynamic scoring to help a company get to grip with its portfolio of receivables. What does that mean exactly?
It's about bringing technology into play to cut down a lot of the legwork that's necessary in the process of collecting cash. And it's about freeing up resource to focus upon the areas where human resource is required in order to actually bring cash into the organization. We talked about global credit line setting. So this is looking at your customers holistically around the globe and not focusing on granting limits at local geographical levels or business unit levels. We talked about the importance as well of internal dispute management processes and playing in some of those metrics that you've acquired through time. It's about also combining your internal metrics that you've collected through your workflow systems and bringing those into the process of scoring a particular account when it comes to setting the credit limits. So we talked a little bit about the dispute management process. It's important to understand what kind of levels of disputes that you would typically get within a customer portfolio and the extent to which that is consuming some of the limits that you've imposed upon a particular account. Because it may well be that an account is still operating well within its acceptable tolerances were it not for the fact that you had an unprecedented level perhaps of disputes in that particular period. So it's about being able to understand that and see that at the same time as looking at the more classical measures of historical credit scoring and industry peer comparisons too.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mark.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Plenty of advice and insight from Mark Lampton. Now let's hear from our panelists what they have to say about receivables management in this current climate. Let's start with you, CJ. You know, sort of Mark talked about going back to basics, but what does that mean actually in this current climate, and what are the challenges of doing so now?
Right. Well, I mean, I look back at my first business class I ever took, and it was cash was king. It matters, but it's not as important the paper profit on your P&L. What really matters is the free cash flow that your company's generating. That's what's important. And for most organizations, for many organizations out there, the free cash flow comes, the largest part of it comes from trade receivables. So managing that trade receivables is key in this credit crisis that we're in. And when I say managing, I mean not only managing the collection piece, but also the credit piece, because it's right now you need to marry the two. And Mark alluded to this, it's really that dynamic managing of the credit, being able to change that risk rate on the fly and have it impact the collection strategies. That's what's key right now. You can't just use the stagnant data that's out there. You can't use a grade that was generated even months ago, 3 months ago. It needs to be updated regularly. You need to constantly score your portfolio and have that credit risk, that changing credit risk, affect the collection strategy. Go in there and actually change the strategy to be something more aggressive where you're going to deploy human resources on the accounts that are at risk. And use your automated systems to do the collection activities on those accounts that you know you're going to get paid on. They're less risky. They may be extending their cycles a little bit, and you want to try and bring them back in. So you're going to get that cash flow, but really put the human resources on the riskiest account.
The key things that I've been hearing from CFOs lately is that really it's a balancing act. How do you drive revenue at the same time as managing that risk? It's not easy, I know, but what are you seeing out there?
It's a very hard thing to do, and you know, the last thing you want is your credit department to be called the sales prevention department, right? So managing those credit lines is a very, very tricky business. And this is where you need to use automation. I think automation helps tremendously by alerting the collection team, the credit analysts, when a credit line's used up, and going out there, being close to your customer, and knowing that you can go out there and say, hey, listen, we have orders that we want to process for you, but we can't because your credit line's used up. You need to make some payments on these outstanding receivables. You know, we want to work with you. We want to make sure that you have the materials that you need, the services that you need in order to generate revenue and free cash flow for your organization, but we got to get payment on some of these outstanding bills.
Yeah. But Daniel, I mean, you know, sort of we're hearing about the challenge and that things are happening so much faster than, let's say, a year or two ago. So what are you seeing in receivables management that you think, yes, I think companies have really indeed improved or are rising to the challenge?
With our clients, we really see two things. One, you are seeing slowing down payment behavior, as well as increased risk of default. So a lot of things that have been said earlier, we would agree with in terms of it is about dynamic risk management, it is about being proactive in your collections. So there's not a number of process things that you can do that will help you. And clearly also technology will help you do that. From our experience in clients, for example, we work with a global consumer electronics customer who used to see early payments by their retailers. Now clearly that sort of willingness is gone and that has puts pressure on the receivables performance. Mm-hmm. So even when you put all those things in, all those new processes and technology, the key thing for us is very much you have to have the right behaviors in the organization as well, because a lot of the normal everyday type actions have to change now, and they have to change quite low in the organization.
Clearly that's not going to happen overnight though, but do you have any sort of quick win pieces of advice that you can provide to change those behaviors?
Well, there's a number of things you can do. Training's clearly one of them, getting the right techniques, getting people an experience of how do you deal with excuses. If you hear certain cues from your customers, should you be worried about this? How do you deal with the excuses? So there are some things you can do, but clearly there are no simple silver bullets that will fix everything. It's trying to get all the parts of the organization aligned, get the sales guys to do the right thing, the credit guys and the collections people, and work in unison rather than look at their own silos. That's going to make the difference.
And Rajesh, I notice you nodding your head in agreement. What does this look like from the bank's perspective?
I think on the receivable side, most of our large corporate customers are driving and informing their banking needs by four drivers in this space. The first is efficiency, the quest for efficiency and cost saves. The second is working capital and liquidity management and its optimization. The third is their risk management processes. And the final part is the need for financing. So across that, what does that mean for the banking industry? Mark mentioned this, the whole point about setting up global credit limits for their global customers. What this means is that the bank has to be in a position to tell the customers, like HP and others of that sort, who paid when so that they can release the credit line. The second piece that we're seeing in that space is the whole order to cash cycle is getting increasingly automated and integrated with the bank. So the commercial processes have to come together with the financial processes, some of the points that Daniel was alluding to, in order for this to be able to work in sync. And that gives the bank the opportunity to get the visibility to help with the risk management, as well as to provide the information, and finally, to make informed financing decisions.
Very good points, in fact. And I think some of those themes actually resonate straight through to payables. So let's look at payables now. So Rajesh, you know, what I've been hearing a lot also, which sort of strikes me as what's different between, you know, sort of now and 2 years ago, is this sensitivity in the supply chain. One CFO commented to me that, you know, our supplier needs the cash more than we do. We'll go easy on them. I don't think we would have heard that 2 years ago, in fact. Would you agree? And what, again, does this look like from the bank's perspective?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of the larger, more enlightened customers have come to the conclusion, especially those that are dependent on smaller suppliers in the supply chain for the success of their business model, that unless they take a wider view and support their suppliers, for many of these suppliers, the relationship with this large buyer is their only source of balance sheet or credit. not an additional, but today, for a lot of these small suppliers, this is their only source. So if the large buyer in its business model believes a healthy supplier is in its best interest, they are lending balance sheet, they are extending payment terms, and they're doing taking a very holistic view to this chain. And that actually is leading to further integration and automation. And again, workflow management across that chain, and again, an opportunity for the bank to insinuate themselves in that chain to add value through financing and risk mitigation.
Speaking of adding value, though, so what's happening in the Treasury Department then, CJ? Sort of, is this a big challenge for them, or is it, are they rising to the challenge in terms of what's going on with accounts payable?
Well, I think they're rising. I think we're seeing a couple of trends as it relates to accounts payable and payments. One of them really is around electronic invoice presentment and payment. We've been hearing this for years. Oh, it's the next greatest thing ever. But now, you know, the necessity is a mother of invention, and we have it here. The buyer, this is the really interesting part. The buy side is forcing the supply side to use EIP Pay. So the buyer saying, hey, you know, I want your invoices. If we're going to buy from you, you need to present your invoices to me electronically. And this allows the buyer to take that information, process it through workflow efficiently, get all the authorizations, and then tee that up for payment, which leads to the second big push that we're seeing right now is payment factories. Companies around the globe are centralizing their payment functions. So instead of having all these payment centers all over the world, they're centralizing the payment function. They're putting the automation in place that allows for taking their payment policy, embedding it in a solution, taking advantage of the SWIFT connectivity, doing SEPA compliance, you know, all the consolidation of payments is just really beneficial for an organization.
Is it really now the time to be doing that type of thing? Payment factories, yes, we can do that later. Let's just get through this downturn first.
Well, I think the efficiencies and the gains that you make, how costly it is to have all those payment centers around the world and to deal with multiple banks, no disrespect for the bankers, but as people, this crisis has opened everybody's eyes. Instead of consolidating on one or two banks, people are realizing that maybe they should have multiple. All that connectivity of those banks is expensive to maintain. And from the bank side as well, for the banks to offer out new services, you have to go update that technology. So if you centralize that, you only have to do it one time in one place, the cost savings is enormous.
Mm. But, you know, it's also about people and processes, and we were talking a lot about technology. So, Daniel, tell me what you're seeing.
From our perspective, I mean, a lot of our clients see that there's a lot of pressure on payables. In fact, the yearly working capital survey that we do together with CFO Magazine actually shows that DPO performance, days payable outstanding, has significantly deteriorated compared to last year. So there is pressure in that system. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think the general misconception is that managing payables is easy. You just stretch your payments and then you stretch your terms, so you pay a bit later. In fact, in this environment, that probably is going to achieve the opposite effect, because you also have to see how do your suppliers think, what credit worthiness they can give to you. Mm-hmm. So risk is a new factor, both for me as a buyer, as for my suppliers. From a buyer's perspective, clearly I want to make sure that I get the supply that I need for my supply chain. So how credit worthy are my suppliers? Will they fold in the next few days? And we've seen some of this, for example, in the automotive sector. As well as the supplier side, we've seen recently, particularly say in the retail industry, people pulling credit insurance. So if I can't insure my exposure with you, can I really continue trading? So from my perspective, that means probably I have to change my terms, lower them, which has an adverse effect on my payables performance as a result.
Yeah. Right. Is that a common practice now? Are you seeing that a lot, though?
It is happening.
Reaction, you know,
it is happening throughout different industries, mm-hmm. more commonly certainly in the last few years. Okay. And what that means is a normal practice of, can we rearrange our terms? Can we pay late? You have to tread very carefully. I think on terms management, you can improve your terms, but you have to be very specific on where you do it. And some markets, for example, commodity markets like metals or copper. Last year, it was a seller's market. This year, it's changed. So they're no longer imposing terms on you. So now is a good time to think about renegotiating. But you have to be very specific and tread carefully.
So to Daniel's points, that situation gets exacerbated when you think of this in a global trade concept. So if you're talking about payables in an international trade context, and you're talking about certain countries or certain industries where commodity prices have been depressed, that issue gets so much more important. Mm-hmm. So the challenge in segmenting your supplier base or your industry, where you can extend and where you need to possibly accelerate payment terms is very important.
But I think going back to the dynamic point, it's also happening, it's changing week by week in many sectors as well. So if you think you've got it figured out in one week, the next week it might be completely different.
That's exactly right. If I could just add 2 points. Yeah. One, I want to really emphasize what we said earlier about companies, the suppliers really tightening those that credit policy, that credit management policy. Exactly what Daniel said. If you're making late payments, they're going to, you know, raise your risk rating and say, hey, listen, this guy's not as creditworthy. He's not paying us on time. They're going to lower your credit limit. It's going to be harder for you to get the raw materials, the services that you need to produce your revenue. So that's exactly in line with everything that we're saying. The second point was really about this visibility, this transparency on the payment side, on the payable side. We can't really play too lightly here. This is really the next big trend that I see in the industry, and I think it's so important right now is to have visibility where your customers' payments are. If you can have that early on in the process, you're not going to put all the work into collecting those receivables. You're not going to put all the work into teeing up that in a work queue for somebody. It's really important, this transparency, that visibility into the payment cycles, and technology lets us do this. Communication lets us do this. Mm-hmm. And the last point I'll make on this, it relates to alternative financing. And having visibility into what an approved payable is, being able to, as a supplier, and the example was a weak supplier or a smaller supplier, let's not use weak, let's use smaller. Smaller suppliers out there, their credit rating may not be that great, and the cost of funds for them to borrow is very, very high. Where if we have a large retailer, a big box retailer with a very good credit rating, by having approved payable and visibility into it, we can extend their credit rating to the supplier and get this alternative financing that we mentioned. Really critical in time.
Certainly a big issue for CFOs, and they want a lot of CFOs of Absolutely. Big companies are saying, well, but how much do we want to do this? But it certainly is a trend that they've at least considered. And some good points raised there. And we're going to look now at the next component of working capital management, inventory management, in fact. Daniel, I would argue that CFOs, this is probably the one area where CFOs feel their hands are tied. If you compare it, payables and receivables, what's happening with inventory, especially after the Q4 drop-off in consumer demand? There are a lot of warehouses sitting there full of inventory.
What we see with our clients clearly is that inventory is probably the one aspect that's most hard hit, particularly since Q4 last year, even Q1 this year. So you can see on the balance sheet those values rising compared to some of the sales falling off. And the normal thing that we always see is when you have volume going through the supply chain, all the process gaps that you normally have are not visible. But as soon as the volume drops off, they come to the fore. It's a little bit like the tide going out on a rocky shore. Yes. So it suddenly becomes much more difficult to maneuver your vessel.
What are some of those gaps, though, that you tend to see most often?
The biggest question is about flexibility and reacting to a change in demand pattern. And that has a number of impacts on the way they manage their processes. For example, your forecast planning is what do you expect to go through the factory. That's going to change when demand pattern drops off. And often they're too slow to react, especially if you have statistical analysis to forecast what you think you're going to produce. A lot of those things are not changed quickly enough. And a lot of the triggers, like your safety stocks, your lead times, your key parameters that the guys in the operations use every day, do take some time to be adjusted. And then you see this buildup of both the healthy inventory, where there's some excess simply because the turnover isn't as high as it used to be, as well as the unhealthy inventory, where you have a long end, tail end of the inventory, which become obsolete and very slow moving because you haven't adjusted your product lines and deciding what you make when quick enough.
Good points. Now, CJ, I mean, you could say that do we really need real-time technology then, or was that the sort of the talk, the jargon from the dot-com boom, and are we managing our technology better to help us with that inventory?
I mean, we are, but I think at the end of the day, it does come down to the process and really syncing up the different departments and just having good basic management principles in place and how we're going to use the technology. The technology's there, but it's how we're going to use it. Do we have the right process in place, and do we have the communication between the different departments?
How do you respond to a CFO who says, though, my hands are tied? It's down to everybody else in the company to sort out our inventory.
well, I think that I would respond to him that he better untie his hands and start finding a way, because that's his job too, right? I mean, if it's part of working capital as a CFO, I'd be really concerned. If you have to bring in experts to help you, if that's not your expertise, then bring in the experts to help. But don't just say, oh, gee, my hands are tied. I promise you there's probably something you can do to better manage your inventory than what you're doing right now.
Good points.
If I could just add to that, in fact, we're seeing a lot of that. Often technology is an excuse why not to do something. Well, I can't see what my inventory is and all that. But in reality, to have the right process helps a lot. And just getting the right mentality in place around cash management, also in the operational side of the business, which often manufacturing lacks, that's where CFO can get involved and say, let's challenge again. Absolutely. Are we getting the right forecasts? What are the replenishment parameters? What batch sizes should we really have to align what you do day to day?
Yeah. Well, that nearly brings us back to the beginning, in fact, when we were talking about back to basics. And so no working capital management discussion would be complete if we didn't talk about the incentives and how do you get everybody back to basics? How do you incentivize people to think about cash? And I think it'd be interesting to hear from you, Rajesh. What can incentives work? Is there a point to introducing new incentives now to help align people around cash?
I think the definitely, and they haven't been used in the past, and I think Mark alluded to them too. For the entire working capital to be successful, you can't do it in finance or treasury. You need an alignment across commercial, the salespeople, risk and credit, and the finance and treasury functions. And the only way this is going to work is if you align those three. And there are two drivers to do that. The first is to get the visibility on whether all that you're trying is having an effect, and that would be having the classical metrics and dashboards. And if they're not moving fast enough purely by just measuring them, you probably need to put in incentives. Mm-hmm. And a very good one is with the sales folks to make sure that cash is king, and it's not really commissionable revenue until we have the cash in the bank.
But do you think a lot of the working capital incentives tend to stay at the top executive level, and they don't bother to drive down because the cash mentality into incentive payments, does it tend to stop? And what do you think should happen there? Is that okay at the executive level?
I think, sorry to cut you off there. You're right, Janet. It has to go all the way down, and it has to be in the collectors, in the credit department. I mean, there's two things. People manage what you measure, and people manage what you pay for. And if you really have to make the sort of change that this would engender, you do need to go all the way down.
Yeah, but CJ, definitely sort of good points, but going all the way down, there's obviously some tensions around sales teams, for example, and ways that you need to think about, right. What's good enough? Do we really incentivize fully? When does an incentive actually become a disincentive?
Well, I'll apply that to the trade receivable world. Mm. And what we've seen is that when you give dollars collected incentives, hey, get this much cash in, it can be a disincentive, to use that word. And I think of it's almost like an HR human resource issue, because if I'm the person that's collecting from the automobile industry, I'm not going to generate as much cash as somebody that's collecting from an industry that's a little bit more healthy. So you have to be really careful with that. And what we've seen are more team-based goals. So to kind of cut it across and have everybody focused on that team-based goal, and what can you do to drive up the cash collected? But to the point earlier, you get what you measure. So what we like to see is for each individual collector in the department, let's sit down with them and say, you develop the cash forecast, we're going to work with you, what do you think this month you're going to collect, this calendar month, this fiscal month, what are you going to collect? They own that number, then every day you monitor. Now you got to use technology, but every day you monitor where you are with the cash, and even use the technology, to Mark's point, to say, hey, here's where you are, you're not there yet, maybe here's some customers that would be able to generate some cash flow if you called them to collect. And that's what it's about.
But, I think, Daniel, it'd be interesting to hear from you. I mean, that's what it's about now. Everybody seems to be focused on cash. But let's go forward a bit, a year or two from now. Is, cash going to be replaced again? And are we going to be back to the old habits and back, sort of away from thinking about cash like we used to?
Well, I think cash should always be on the agenda now. It's quite obvious because your funding situation has changed. And in general, I think companies need more of a cash culture. And incentives should be part of that. as long as the right KPIs, and I completely agree with CJ that they should cascade down. You probably want to have different KPIs at different levels. A DSO means a lot to a CFO. It might not mean that much to a collector, so you want to address that and make sure they know what they're shooting for. But incentives should be part of that. In terms of will it change a number of years back, generally, I would say to any of our clients, well, you want to have a balanced scorecard in your organization, so you don't measure just EBITDA or revenue because this is the thing of the of the time. Mm-hmm. Exactly what we see in 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. You should try and balance each of the three components, EBITDA, revenue, and cash, to try and get a good balance. Just improving one is relatively easy. Getting the right balance between all of them is much more difficult.
Thank you, Daniel. We've covered a lot of ground in our first Cash Clinic today. And before we draw it to a close, I'd like to thank our panelists, CJ of SunGuard's Avantgarde, Daniel of Ariel,
thank you very much,
and Rajesh Mehta of Citi, and Mark and Jason over in our remote studio. We hope you found today useful, and we're looking forward to seeing you at our next Cash Clinics coming soon. Thank you very much.